Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society equips and encourages Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. We have a busy year ahead, so definitely stay tuned. We got our fall symposium this October 22nd through the 24th. In Holland, Michigan. A tentative program is now available and on the website, and registration is open. Our 2027 spring conference will be at Regent University in Virginia Beach, March 11th through the 13th, and the proposals for that are due September 1st, 2026, which I think will be not long after this episode gets posted, probably sometime in August. We'll also be launching the Logres Institute for Classical Studies this fall. Registration for that is also open. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we go any further, I'd like to open with prayer. Heavenly Father, we ask that in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, you would bless this conversation and guide us by your Holy Spirit. May all we say and do bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I am very excited today to be joined by Ciceronian Society member Michael Lucchese. Michael Lucchese is founder and CEO of Pipe Creek Consulting, as well as a contributing editor to Providence Magazine and an associate editor of Law and Liberty. He is the editor of a new collection of writings, which is the topic of today's episode. These are writings by Russell Kirk called On America, How to Understand the Legacy of 1776, published by Creed and Culture. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Josh, great to be on.
So I love Russell Kirk. He's come up a lot on this show. In full disclosure, I was a Wilbur Fellow at the Russell Kirk Center. I'm friends with the family, and he is such an interesting author, and I think this is such an appropriate book for a particular moment. But I'm curious, now that the book has been published, let's begin with what you intend this book to do or show. What was your goal in putting this together?
Yeah, so I think that with a lot of America 250 celebrations, well-intentioned as they may be, I think some of them have been kind of surface level. Some of them have sort of been this sort of just celebration of the country generally without maybe digging deep into what makes the country, right? And I think Dr. Kirk was actually one of the best people to turn to understand the deepest roots of American order, our connection with antiquity, what makes America different from antiquity, and not just from a political perspective, but also a literary, a philosophical perspective. So I hope what this book shows is that America goes a lot deeper than we might be inclined to think at first.
You know, just the way you said that made me think of, I think it's Edgar Schein who talks about the iceberg model, where there's artifacts, espoused values, and underlying assumptions of an organization. He's specifically talking about organizational culture. It is funny how obsessed these celebrations can get. And I'm guilty of this in kind of a funny way, where it's all about those symbols, right? Like just, you know, I love the flag. Let's just wrap ourselves in it and root for the U.S. to beat Belgium. Sadly, it did not happen. or just, you know, all the memes with eagles in them, right? all these things are great, but Kirk does. He says, you know, look, those are important. I'm not saying they aren't, but there's all these underlying historical aspects to this. Now, and I've been in the archives. I know that Kirk has written a lot on the American founding. And so you had to make some tough decisions. How did you determine what to include, what to leave out?
Yeah, so the book is divided into three sections. The first section is on the revolution and the founding itself. The second section is on American statesmanship. So some of the key figures that Kirk admired or did not admire, as it were, throughout American history, from John Adams to John Randolph Roanoke, Abraham Lincoln, Ronald Reagan. And then the last section, which in some ways is, in my opinion, the most important section, is on American literature. And I'm very pleased to say that there are two previously unpublished essays in this collection. One is a speech that Dr. Kirk gave on Abraham Lincoln in the 1970s, and sort of going through what he admired about Abraham Lincoln. And then the second is an essay on Mark Twain, which I think is really interesting in as far as it reveals something about what Dr. Kirk thought about the general trajectory of American literature in the 19th century, and how those conservative ideas that he felt were the essence of the American Republic sort of played out in each of these realms, both the founding itself and the spirit of the revolution, to statesmanship and prudentially navigating the great crises our nation has faced, and then to literature and how we really express ourselves in the most profound way.
Yeah, Kirk was definitely, I mean, he's known as essentially this father of modern intellectual conservatism, I think rightly. But he's, you know, people think about conservative today, they only think about the political side of it, right? A set of policy programs. It was really refreshing when I first encountered Russell Kirk to realize, oh, it's more than just being a Republican. In fact, many times it's not being a Republican, frankly, lately. But it was so rich to find out that that the idea of conservatism was so much deeper than politics. And I mean, it's been, you know, decades now since I first encountered him, but that was really good. Now, you got Brad Berger to write the foreword, also a Ciceronian Society member. Dr. Berger writes in the foreword, he writes, quote, "Kirk believed that America served the world as a kind of anamnesis, a remembrance that returns us to right reason and the proper ordering of things." You've kind of already answered that, but what do you make of that particular description of Kirk?
Yeah, I think that's great. He took that phrase from Eric Voegelin's political theory, and it means basically remembering. And so for Kirk, what's important about the revolution is not so much that it's starting something wholly new or introducing modes and orders wholly new, something like that. It's not a Machiavellian revolution or something like that. Rather, it's a return to what Kirk is frequently refers to as the old moral order. And by that he means the civilizational inheritance that we can trace from Jerusalem to Athens to Rome to London to Philadelphia, right? This great idea of the West, a man in a certain dignified way, bound together in community, aiming at some higher end virtue. And so the American Revolution and the American Republic, the life of the American Republic, reminds the whole world of these things. And one of the essays I collect in here on Orestes Bronson, The American Mission, Dr. Kirk talks about how the American mission is not so much to sort of dominate the world or totally completely remake the world in its image, but rather teach the nations that you can reconcile liberty and law, that freedom and order can go hand in hand. So I think insofar as it's a remembering, it's sort of a remembering of the true dignity of man. And that's something that's really important to recover, and that I think is left out on both in a lot of celebrations of America, on both the right and the left today.
Yeah, I selfishly kind of bring up the phrase anamnesis. You might recall that the original journal that we had was called Anamnesis for Ciceronian Society. We've since renamed it Pietas. I won't discuss in the show why we had to change the name, but it also gets to the heart of kind of what we do as a society, trying to recall and remember those things, return us to right reason, right imagination, right living in different ways, and how scholars, Christian scholars, can be part of that. Another theme that is related, especially, you know, dear and dear to us at the Ciceronian Society, is place. Berger points this out in the foreword, because Kirk, I don't know if you, I don't know anywhere where he specifically elaborates on the theme of place in kind of a systematic way, but it permeates so much of his writing, including his fiction. Why do you think that's especially important for this book?
Yeah, so I think for Dr. Kirk, if I were to sort of try to systematize his thoughts on this, what I would say is that the particular the universal, which is very, very important to him, I think this is something that people misunderstand about his traditionalism. He was not a radical particularist the way that some people were. He truly thought there were universals that we ought to aspire to conserve, that we ought to build our lives around. But he also understood that the universal is only ever incarnated in the particular. So he loved America because he loved America's ideas, but also because he was from America. He was from a particular part of America, and his love, they're kind of like, you know, nesting dolls, right? His love for America, you dig a little deeper and it's a love for Michigan, and you dig a little deeper and it's love for especially Mecosta, Michigan, right? So I think that's why place matters, right? Place matters because it's the realm of action in which we are in. but also because it's an expression of the universal, maybe even Platonic truths at the heart of existence. So we can only know those universals through those particulars, and therefore place has to be take a truly foremost position in any kind of humane conservatism.
This reminds me kind of comically of kind of how the particular points to the universal. I made a new friend recently, and he was from California, and he came to visit West Michigan, and he wanted to go to a local restaurant. And I said I recommended a place, and we went there, and he gets the bill because he's offered to pay for it, and he looks at it, and the price was so much lower than California, and that brought him to me. This is America. Yeah, that's what he said. This is real America. But we say in a less superficial sense, we say that when we go to certain places, right? Gosh, this just feels American, right? In that sense, or American, as I might put it, right? And there is something, whatever the there is in the sense of what America is, you only ever encounter it in particular ways. It doesn't mean that the universal idea of what America is gone. It just means that, as Kirk recognized, you're never going to encounter the universal America, right? You're only ever going to encounter it in the particular. It doesn't mean the universal doesn't exist. And I realize that's a philosophically deep and controversial topic we don't need to go too far into. But that's
Well,
also, yeah, go ahead.
to add one more point to this, I think it's important to say this is not a sort of provincial particularism either, right? It's not
Right,
because he
right.
didn't get beyond the bounds of his place. Dr. Kirk was a world traveler. He crossed the Sahara Desert. He lived in Rome. He lived in Scotland. He traveled all over the world, all over America. And he didn't love his own place any less, right? In some ways, he actually brought those places to him, not just with stories of his travels or souvenirs, but also people, right? And he made Macosta a place of pilgrimage for a lot of people today, and refuge for a lot of people in his own time. And I think that says something about his patriotism. It's not hostile and closed off to outside things. It's open to them because it sees all of these particulars as ways of a ladder to those universals, right? And I think that's what maybe distinguishes his American patriotism from forms of nationalism, say, that are very prominent today. It's not about isolation. It's not about being closed off. Rather, it's about loving the things that are in front of us.
When we're recording this, the World Cup is going on, and it makes me think of I was having this conversation recently with someone how when you watch the World Cup and you see the way these countries respond to their teams, the nationalistic fervor, if we can call it that, is so deep. Like they're just weeping and crying, wrapping themselves, painting themselves in the flag. I love it, but at the same time, like in other contexts, it might worry you a little bit. At the same time, there is a sense in which, and I think Kirk would recognize this, when the Norwegians play, he sees something beautiful in how much Norwegians love Norway, right? Or in how much the French love France. There's going to be that aspect, to the extent that they do. But I think he sees that well.
To this point, when Dr. Kirk was building an addition to Piety Hill, his house in Macosta, he built the windowsills short enough so that his little girls could look out and see the 4th of July parade in town, right? And he loved the 4th of July. He would dress up for it, flags festooned everywhere, right? He loved it all. And I think that helping a child see the wonder in that is really one of the most beautiful ways a man can express his patriotism, because it's about inviting someone in to this great republic rather than maybe keeping someone out.
So there's a lot of places we could go with that, all controversial. But let's speaking of controversy, one of the things that Kirk does bring up in these writings in the American Founding, and he's deliberately engaging with political theorists and political scientists, is his antagonism toward social contract theory. He's not he, he I would say mixed feelings, but I would say mostly antagonism toward it. What's going on there, and how does that complicate his view of the founding?
Yeah, so I think we can set up two figures in opposition to each other. On the one hand, we have John Locke, the preeminent social contract theorist, and on the other hand, you have Edmund Burke, who I think offers a major correction to John Locke, right? So Burke's critique of sort of Lockean social contract theory, I'm playing a little fast and loose here, but Burke's critique, as it were, is that, well, you can't just treat society like it's a commercial contract, right? This is something very, very different from what we get in the realm of economics, of the realm of finance, right? Society is an eternal contract between the dead, the living, and the unborn. It's not just something that can be made or unmade, as it were, in the blink of an eye or the stroke of a pen. And so Kirk is trying to understand the American founding from a Burkean as opposed to a Lockean perspective. I think that this is an extremely valid way to look at the American founding. Locke, as Dr. Kirk says in Roots of American Order, is no monarch in the realm of American political thought. He's rarely cited at the Constitutional Convention. Even his influence on the Declaration of Independence is something that we could debate for hours if we really wanted to. And so I think what Dr. Kirk is trying to do in his work, insofar as he's trying to sort of revive this Burkean spirit or Burkean interpretation of the founding, is show us that our country means something so much more than just physical security or economic prosperity or general necessity, right? That's not why we love America. Those things are good. He certainly doesn't dispute that. He was a free marketer. He believed in a strong national security. But at the same time, the ultimate question is if society is merely a commercial contract, why would a patriot die for society, right?
Right, yeah.
I think what Dr. Kirk is trying to do is say, enough of this sort of cold rationalism. Let's really talk about what is worth loving here, right? What do we love about our ancestors? What do we love looking forward about our descendants? What do we love about the here and now? And how can we preserve those things? How can we align those things with the permanent things that are essential to the human condition?
That's an interesting way to think of Burke's notion of the social contract. Was he's not just thinking, it's a contract. It's not really a contract. It's about what you love, right? The thing, the past, the present, and the future, and the people and the places that make it up. Well, Locke's, where is love in Locke's social contract theory? There's none in Hobbes, but or well, I mean, hey, you know what? If you're listening and you're a Locke or a Hobbes scholar, and I know you're out there, feel free to propose a paper. That'd be a really interesting topic. Where is love in kind of the traditional social contract theories, in that respect? I think you can see it in Burke to the extent that he is a contract theorist. Or going back to, the lesser known contract theories of people like Suarez. In a another episode, by the way, there we did a we talked about how Cicero could be, or I don't know if it was in an episode or in an article I wrote. I don't remember anymore. But essentially, Cicero's influence on Locke is important here as well. So, I mean, when there are certainly thinkers today who write on the American founding and act as if Locke wrote the Declaration of Independence, that's just incredibly overstated. I think he has an impact, but he's one of many people, right? I mean, you can't really discount Blackstone and Hume and Cicero and all the Roman thinkers, for that matter. As well as just experience, right? That these men had. Now, speaking of some of these controversies, this year we're celebrating the Declaration of Independence in what, 12 years? Am I getting the math right? We're going to celebrate the 250th of the Constitution, presumably. Actually, it'll probably be a much more muted celebration, quite frankly. Again, but there were some older founders, like I think Patrick Henry's an example, some of the Anti-Federalists and others, who thought that the Constitution betrayed the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence was more, Lockean and Republican. The Constitution, was it taking us back to, British thought, essentially? Are we just becoming England again? Where does Kirk land on this, I think, very prescient debate?
Yeah, so I think that Kirk sometimes has a reputation for being a kind of anti-declarationist, if I can use the term, because of some of his associations and some of his well, some of the things that his friends wrote in 20th century conservative disputes about the Declaration and the Constitution. Personally, I don't buy it. He loves the Declaration. He cites the Declaration with some frequency. He praises the Declaration at great length in Roots of American Order and elsewhere. So I think it's wrong to sort of see Dr. Kirk as an anti-declarationist or something like that. What he certainly is not, is somebody who wants to reduce the Declaration to a kind of ideological formula. Or who sees the Constitution as a kind of restatement of the Declaration or something like that, right? He's very aware of the particular context in which the Declaration was written. Now, of course, he's also aware that the ideas that the Declaration expresses are universal and are a true conception of justice that we can put up and in competition against other conceptions, especially when he was writing the communist notion of justice. But he doesn't see the Declaration as something designed to set the world on fire, right? Or to totally remake American society. It was not inaugurating a social revolution or anything like that. And so interpretations of the Constitution that try to use the Declaration, as it were, to remake American society, he has very little sympathy for, right? And I think that in a lot of ways, it's actually Abraham Lincoln who best encapsulates how Dr. Kirk thought the Declaration and the Constitution sort of relate to each other, right? The Declaration gives us these important principles: all men are created equal, government by consent is the only just form of government. But at the same time, he's not a let justice come even if the heavens fall kind of guy, neither Lincoln nor Kirk, right? And so the Constitution is really what, as it were, constitutes our order, right? This is sort of Harvey Mansfield and Harry Jaffa once had an infamous debate about whether America had a declarationist or a constitutional soul. And Mansfield's answer was a America has a constitutional soul. And I think Dr. Kirk generally would agree with Mansfield on that point.
I think, and this next question kind of gets at some of that because of how he places a lot of emphasis on statesmen and statesmanship. I'm curious what you think you read him meaning by that. And specifically, it'd be interesting to talk about, there's three figures that come up in this book and elsewhere in his writings. John Adams, big fan. But then, what does Kirk do with the Alien and Sedition Acts? We got John Randolph of Roanoke, but can't overlook his racism. That's a pretty big deal. And then, you've already mentioned Lincoln, but there's some unconstitutional, frankly, tactics that Lincoln uses to prosecute the Civil War. Does that, how does Kirk think of statesmanship when he looks at these otherwise imperfect men, and in some ways imperfect in spectacular ways? And so, I mean, again, I say imperfect, and you compare it to today. It's hard to even. They seem, it almost seems, I don't know, gratuitous. I don't know if that's the word,
What I
but
would give for a John Randolph of Roanoke on the floor of the
right.
Senate
Yeah.
today.
I mean, it's hard to, I mean, it's like, do we want racist? No, but gosh, at least he knows how to talk and he understands economic, there's a lot to be said about the fact that I think one of the things that I've reflected on in the America 250 stuff is how do we go from that to this, right? Which is a totally different podcast. But I think Kirk is onto that too. Anyways, back to his notion of statesmanship, and thinking specifically about people like John Adams, John Randolph, and Lincoln.
Yeah, so the all three of those figures that you mentioned are wildly different, right? That's one of the things I love about Dr. Kirk's vision of statesmanship, right? This is true of especially the conservative mind. He's pulling people from all these different factions and traditions that wouldn't have gotten along in life, and he's sort of pulling at the conservative thread in their thought, sort of identifying what is truly conservative about these people. And how can we sort of use it to construct a conservative identity today? I'll address Lincoln and Adams together, and then I think I'll say something about Randolph. Lincoln and Adams, both, I think your sort of implicit critique of them, Josh, there was that they are maybe overusing or abusing executive power, right? The Alien and Sedition Acts, maybe Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus, something like that. I think the first thing to say is that Kirk was not a legal scholar. In a sense he was, but he was not a lawyer, right? Insofar as he was a constitutional historian, he was not writing about sort of the nitty-gritties of case law too frequently, right? That wasn't really the way that he was writing. So this is maybe a sort of judgment from looking at the whole of his writings on figures like Adams and Lincoln. I think Kirk has a broader view of executive power than maybe other conservatives of a traditionalist stripe have. Maybe that has something to do with his Anglophilia. Maybe there's a sort of latent monarchist strain in his thought. I personally admire that a great deal. I know that it's, to use the word that you've been using, Josh, controversial. So I think a lot of these constitutional disputes, whether it's alien sedition, habeas corpus, whatever it is, I think Kirk is maybe on the side of a stronger executive than is frequently remarked upon. So that's in the first place. In the second place, though, I think what you have to understand is, for Kirk, order is the first need of all, right? That's the really important thing. And what he admires about Adams, what he admires about Lincoln, is they were leading their country at a time of disorder, and they didn't impose order so much. Maybe Lincoln imposed order, but they didn't impose order so much as they preserved it, right? They said, our Constitution is fundamentally good. Our Constitution is not a suicide pact. We don't have to accept that the forces of anarchy are going to overwhelm us, and instead, we're going to preserve our republic. And so in terms of prudence, I think that's sort of the real thing here, right? Prudence is not this open-ended Machiavellian virtue, right? It's not just trying to hold on to power for power's sake. As Lincoln puts it in one fragment that I think Kirk cites in The Roots of American Order, the Union has a philosophical cause, right? And so defending these particulars, we're doing it for the sake of the universal, right? And that's I think the key to American statesmanship for Kirk in a lot of ways. Now, on Randolph and slavery, I think it's also fascinating because Randolph would not have agreed at all with anything I just said about executive power, right? He may have challenged me to a duel, sicked his hunting dogs on me. So the point there, though, is not that. I think the point is not that we have to have total agreement as conservatives about things like executive power, about Lincoln's use of habeas corpus, about the Alien and Sedition Acts, right? The point is, how are each of these figures defenders of order in their own way, and what does that teach us about the order we've inherited, right? And so Randolph, in the conservative mind, and he of course is the figure about whom Kirk wrote his first book, Randolph emerges as this defender of traditional rule virtues, right? He defends the small farm. He defends the agricultural interests against the industrial interest. And yeah, he does that by, in some ways, defending slavery. It's very unfortunate. And in some ways, especially in that Randolph biography, I wish that Kirk had stared that a little bit more directly in the face and said, here are the problems with it. Nevertheless, Kirk was not an apologist for slavery at all. Randolph, honestly, was not really an apologist for slavery. Famously, he emancipated his slaves upon his death and settled them in Ohio. His descendants, the descendants of those slaves, still live there, actually. There's something interesting about place in that too. I believe Tocqueville encountered this community when he was visiting America. And so these people are all imperfect. They're not going to agree with each other on every nicety of constitutional, political, literary life. That's not the point, right? The point is not to provide some uniform ideology. The point is to say, here is the sort of we're sh as T.S. Eliot might put it, we're sh shoring up the broken fragments, right? We're trying to understand what is order, what is American order, and how can that inform how we live, how we live our political lives today. And needless to say, I don't think very many people in Washington are doing that, but I have higher hopes for the American people more broadly.
Well, yeah, you're more hopeful than I am, but I think there is something there where I thought, I mean, initially reading Kirk, you get that the importance of order, and immediately as a conservative, I'm like, yes. But then again, you're hinting at this is the sense that, okay, what kind of order? Who decides? That's very libertarian of me to say, but there is something to that, and I think Kirk recognized, like, look, you could have order and an incredible amount of injustice at the same time, right? There's an order to North Korea, you could say, but it's not an order that we, it is an order worth overturning because it's not a just order, right? It's not a, it's not, yeah, and that's why it's easy to see how he can look at someone like Randolph and be like, yes, Randolph's all about order. He gets this big piece wrong, at least at first, and then eventually, writes it at his death, to a point.
Yeah, Stephen Mastey, who was a student at Hillsdale College, a friend of the Kirk family, now sadly passed away. I think a friend of many members of the Ciceronian Society, actually. He once told a story about how he was driving with Dr. Kirk in the Michigan back roads, I think probably driving him to Hillsdale College to teach a class. And Dr. Kirk was saying something about how if he had been born in ancient Egypt, he would have been the most radical revolutionary because that order, that cosmological empire was so evil. The difference is, the question is, Lincoln once said of Henry Clay that he loved his country partly because it was his own country, but mostly because it was a free country. And I think that's true of Dr. Kirk as well, right? He loves the old moral order partly because it's his, but also mostly because he thinks it's right. And statesmanship is really about trying to discern that sort of thing.
I'm wondering then, so we're talking a lot about politics, statesmanship, things like that. I want to move to this, the part of the book that you said was probably most important, and I actually would agree with you. To what extent, well, first of all, I'm wondering to what extent does he distinguish between the statesman and the man of letters, right? That was what Kirk was, a man of letters. And does he elevate the man of letters above the statesman? Is the teacher of literature and in history and philosophy, are they more important? Or do you think the observation goes too far? Not only, first of all, is that Kirk's observation, but we can also have the discussion here. I mean, is Kirk right? Are those people, should they matter as much in Kirk's story and in our own?
Well, I think it's significant that Kirk, the only time he ever served in public office was as Justice of the Peace of Mecosta County. He did not run for Congress. He did not run even for his state house, right? Which is not to say he wasn't involved with, he was very involved with politics. He wrote speeches for Barry Goldwater. He campaigned for Ronald Reagan, right? He was very, very, very much involved in contemporary politics. On both sides of the Atlantic, even. He was involved in Conservative Party politics in the United Kingdom. But at the same time, he chooses to be a man of letters, not a politico. And I think that's significant. It seems to me that he Dr. Kirk is of the opinion that the man of letters, that the literary mind provides a more lasting influence on the Commonwealth. And perhaps relatedly, conservatism, Dr. Kirk says in The Conservative Mind, is often more successful in literature than politics, right? One example from the other side of the Atlantic that we might cite is the example of Sir Walter Scott, who not only wrote the Waverley novels, which were wildly successful and sort of gave the United Kingdom in the period after the Napoleonic Wars a real sense of identity, of historical continuity, but also discovered other great literary talents like Lord Byron, Jane Austen, people like that, and sort of shape people through his critical eye. He even inspired American authors like James Fenimore Cooper, who wrote The Leatherstocking Tales, partly inspired by Walter Scott Washington Irving. And so I think that it is the man of letters ultimately who has the greater and wider and more conservative influence on a commonwealth, necessary as the statesman's vocation is. And so I think the next pressing question is kind of, does America have a good literature? Do we have a literature that communicates that kind of conservative, that conservative mentality?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think one of the traditions of American literature is criticizing America, right? That's one of the pastimes is not so much developing an identity, but destroying whatever they think it is. I don't that's a longer conversation. Again, a good panel for the Ciceronian Society Conference. What does it mean to be American, American literature? When you can look at someone who's like, you have Thoreau, right, and Emerson, but you also have, later authors who are very certainly American, but not, again, not necessarily pro-Constitution, right? There's a lot to be said here, right? About what is the true is American literature all about rebellion and liberty? Does it actually have a an affection for order? In some cases, the answer is no. In some cases, the answer might be yes. And to what extent is one of the things that I think is interesting now is that if you're looking at the imagination of how a country understands itself. Has film really replaced literature as becoming more important than these? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, it'd be interesting to say to look at a recent show like Yellowstone, which I didn't watch, but I bet you could do some really interesting work on that and saying what does this say about the American imagination, like what we think of as being American, and different stages. Think could you make the movie The Patriot today? Right? I mean, that would be. But at the same time, look at the success of, and I haven't seen it yet. I don't know if you have, but the new movie Young Washington, I really want to see that. That looks really good. And I've heard good things. I could be wrong, but.
Fisher Ames was a Massachusetts congressman, a sort of leader of the Federalist Party, and he's one of the conservative minds Dr. Kirk talks about it in the book. He's a little critical of Fisher Ames. Fisher Ames was deeply pessimistic. He thought the American Revolution was kind of a mistake. He came to sort of feel that it was kind of a mistake. But Ames, in an essay that he wrote in the early 19th century, titled "American Literature," asks a question which sort of haunts me, which is, can Thomas Paine contend with Plato? Can Joel Barlow contend with Homer? And what he's sort of saying is, we have not, America, the American Republic has not produced these sort of great literary figures. Instead we're stuck with political pamphlets and this sort of third-rate Jeffersonian poet. And I think Fisher Ames, if he were to survey American culture, would perhaps despair even more today, because I'm not sure how compelled he would be by a TV show like Yellowstone or a movie like The Patriot. But I think Dr. Kirk parts ways with Ames here a little bit. And so the first literary figure I profiled in this section that I collected is Nathaniel Hawthorne, who in some ways is, I think either he or James Fenimore Cooper laid claim to being the first great American novelist. And what Dr. Kirk thought was great about Hawthorne was two things, which are related. First, there's a historical sensibility in Hawthorne, right? America is not just this new thing that emerged in 1776. It's not like Benjamin Franklin hit his lightning bolt to the ground and George Washington charged it out with a horse. That wasn't how America got started. And Hawthorne's like particularly interested in the history of his own region, New England, the history of the Puritans, sort of going back hundreds of years and sort of asking, all right, What is really the origin of American life? What are we doing on the, what did we bring forth on this new continent, right? So that's the historical aspect is one important thing. But the other important thing is that Hawthorne reminds us of the reality of original sin, right? Maybe he reminds us a little too much of it. Maybe Hawthorne is a little too obsessed with original sin. By doing so, he both chastens America and he says, look, we're not regenerate, man. Like, our political experience is not regenerating us. It's not making us new men. But at the same time, he's sort of expressing the greatness of America through that sense of historical continuity in another way, right? We are hewing a civilization out of the frontier here. And that's not to say that there's not rot, that there's not corruption, that original sin has been purged somehow, but Hawthorne is really the foundation for a truly great American literature, and I think that's what Herman Melville understood. I think that's what Flannery O'Connor understood, and I think that that's really the start of sort of perhaps refuting Fisher Ames's pessimistic claims about American literature. No, we might not have a Plato or a Homer, but we do have a Nathaniel Hawthorne. We do have a Robert Frost. We do have a T.S. Eliot.
Well, yeah, and there's almost a to have a Plato or a Hawthorne, I mean a Plato or a Homer. That's the expectation just seems unreasonable. England has their Shakespeare, and then, right? But coming up on a future episode, by the way. So I want to turn to the we've talked about place, we've talked about tradition. Let's talk about things divine. So Russell Kirk's faith is complicated at times through his life. I don't think there's ever a time where he would have considered himself an atheist. I don't think. There's certainly times where he can be despairing, especially during World War II and earlier. But then he meets Annette, who is still among us as we record this. She will probably outlive me. I think she's what, 120? Just kidding. But his wife, and when they got married, I think it's 1964. He and I think before that, right? He converts to Catholicism, but he was never hostile to faith. He was certainly sympathetic, and eventually becomes, I think, more and more a deeper part of his life as he gets older. How though? Let's focus on the American founding though. We continue this debate of did America have a Christian founding, and what was the relationship of Christianity to the American founding? Where does Kirk land on that question?
Kirk is firmly in the Christian America camp, as it were, but maybe not exactly the way people talk about this today, right? He certainly was not interested in efforts to sort of impose a national religion or something like that. He had no illusions about the reality of disestablishment. He was in favor of things like school prayer, to be sure, but he also wasn't convinced really that those things would, government coercion could actually make America a religious place again or something like that. Rather, I think what he's trying to do is show that our political and literary assumptions, our first principles, come from a religious order. And of course, Roots of American Order, he starts off by talking about the Jewish inheritance, ancient Israel, how the Hebrew Bible sort of informed the American founding. He talks about Christianity and how everyone from Augustine to Constantine sort of influenced American life from afar too. And so I think one of the ways that you maybe could think about how Kirk considers America is there have been all these attempts throughout human history to sort of unpack the civilizational assumptions of Christianity and say, all right, how can we build a truly Christian civilization? And our institutions, one way to understand them is it is our own way of building a Christian civilization. Limited government, that's one way that we can build a Christian civilization. Classical education, that's one way that we can build a Christian civilization. Even religious toleration is one way that we can build a kind of Christian civilization. So I think it's that civilizational component that Kirk would emphasize rather than a sort of political utilizing religion in a political way, which I think is what some of modern what it sometimes described as Christian nationalism might slip into. I think one way of critiquing that maybe is Kirk, I don't know if he would put it in exactly these terms, but I think he would probably side with me on this question. I think the sort of political utilization of religion can have become sort of Machiavellian. America is founded in a rejection of that kind of Machiavellianism, precisely because it is unchristian.
There's a lot of places we could go with that. Again, good panel topics. I just keep plugging this, plugging it, in the sense that is that, well, I don't want to go down that Christian nationalist integralist road. Anybody who's listening might know about that. In general, our president, James Patterson, fights that fight on Twitter every day, usually getting numerous threats all the re regularly. But I got two more questions for you. I want to go to chapter four in the book. It's called Renewing a Shaken Culture. And Kirk seems to be suggesting that America's cultural debt and connection to Britain actually endured beyond the founding era and the Declaration of Independence. And he also, I think interestingly, sees parallels of decline between the two countries, especially due to the poison of multiculturalism. What do you make of that? And I think it's a really important chapter because it's also remarkably unsettling. So if Kirk is right, is the mess that it currently is, the United Kingdom, frankly, is that in our future, right? Are we headed there too, just faster? And again, you don't have to answer that future question is tangential to a point, but to what extent does Kirk connect the United States and Britain? Do you think he overstates it? And where is this headed?
So I definitely don't think he overstates it. I think that so the title of one of his last books in his own life, which several chapters of this new collection are taken from, is America's British Culture. And I think that's basically true. Our folkways, I mean, the language that you and I are talking in, right, was born in the British Isles. Our folkways are British. Shakespeare was an important point of reference for the founders, for Lincoln, for I hope us today still. And so I think that Britain and America are sort of culturally inseparable, even though we're politically separated. Consanguinity is the word that the founders used in the Declaration of Independence to describe the relationship between these two nations. So in Dr. Kirk's memoir, Sword of Imagination, he describes a similar experience when he goes to the South to study at Duke University and get his master's degree, and when he goes to the United Kingdom to study at St. Andrews in Scotland for his DLit. In both of these places, he sort of sees a vision of order, right? It's not perfect, certainly not perfect in the South, certainly not perfect in Britain, but he sort of sees by going to these places that are sort of similar to what he knows from Michigan, but sort of different in a whole bunch of ways. He sees ways that the he sees that ladder from the particular to the universal, right? And so I think it's really important that we sort of look at British constitutional and cultural history and say, all right, here's the essence of this political experience. And here's how it informs our own. I recently wrote a piece for Law and Liberty, lamenting the expulsion of the hereditary lords from the House of Lords in the United Kingdom. We don't have hereditary lords in the United States. We definitely should not, right? I think aristocracy would not work in this polity that way at least. But nonetheless, I think that we're witnessing the sort of decline of order in the United Kingdom in a really troubling way. That should be especially troubling to us as Americans, right? We have a relationship with this place. We should hope and pray that that place flourishes. And the fact that it's not ought to be a sort of reminder of the possibility that, this could all go up in flames, right? Rome went up in flames. America could go up in flames too. Britain might be going up in flames right now.
Literally and figuratively, yeah.
And I think Publius's remark at the beginning of Federalist One that it seems to have been reserved to us to decide the important question for all time, whether men are capable of good government by reflection and choice, or whether we're always going to rely for our political constitutions on accident and force. I think that's something that Dr. Kirk is really reckoning with in a lot of his work. And to be clear, he's very much on the side of reflection and choice, right? He does not think that it is mere accident and force which governs the affairs of men. But I think the example of Britain today is a reminder of our responsibility. Whether they can find their way back to renewal or not, and I certainly hope they do. We as America are the last best hope for deciding that question, and the question is even more important for us in a lot of ways. So it's a reminder of responsibility, a reminder of the duties of citizenship, I think.
Well, and I think that kind of gets to the last question, but I want to give you the last word here, in the sense that what do you hope we take away from this, the way forward for conservatives and our understanding of America? I mean, what? But to put this another way, and again, this would be a good another good panel topic. I just keep coming up with them. America 251, right? Essentially, if we are to endure another 251 years, what does a figure like Russell Kirk offer us? To get to the American 500th anniversary.
Yeah, so I think conservatism, Graham McAleer in a recent book, The Wisdom of Our Ancestors, describes conservatism as a doctrine of crisis, right? It emerges in response to like particular crises, the French Revolution, say, and we could go on, right? But I think conservatism is always sort of tempted by the declension narrative, right? Everything started out good and now everything is bad, and woe is us. There's a truth in there. I don't want to deny that. I don't think Dr. Kirk would deny that. One of the things toward the end, I paired two chapters, an early essay Dr. Kirk wrote on Henry and Brooks Adams, sort of inheritors of the Adams political family and their legacy. The End of the Conservative Mind on T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost. And what you sort of get, the second half of The Conservative Mind can be somewhat depressing to read, right? Because all these British and American conservatives, they're losing all the time. They're not winning. You get these occasional great men, Lincoln, Disraeli, so on and so forth. But really, politics in the second half of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century was a low and grubby thing, right? It's not very inspirational to read about some of these figures. And Henry and Brooks Adams, their sort of response is, the title of the chapter is History Without Providence, right? They sort of lose faith, and they sink into this kind of what we might describe as conservative despair. And there's something really important about that despair, right? Henry Adams was a profound philosophical thinker who I think is underappreciated in America today. But it is despair, and despair is a sin, right? And so turning from them and their conservative despair, we get these poets, Robert Frost, T.S. Eliot, and Kirk argues that they offer us a conservative hope, right? Their poetry shows us a way back to the transcendent. It shows us a way back to the universal. It shows us a way back to the light from the darkness. In no small part, I think, especially in Eliot's case, because he was such a profound Christian, and because of his spiritual agony on his way to becoming a son of the church. There is a hope here. And I think that's really what I hope people take away from On America, right? There's a hope embedded in our republic. There's a political expression of it. There's a poetic expression of it. There's a religious expression of it. And I think the conservatives' task today is to recover that hope. Recovering that hope, that cultural, that civilizational activity is way more important than any political or partisan activity that we can participate in. And so I hope what this book does is it encourages people to dig deep into the roots of America and try to understand them, try to understand the founders as they understood themselves, try to understand Kirk as he understood himself, and maybe we can understand ourselves a little bit better too.
Excellent. Well, Michael, thank you so much for this book, putting these writings together. The link to the book published by Creed and Culture is in the show notes, and I definitely encourage you all to take a look, especially if you're new to Russell Kirk. It is a great entree into his writings. There's also a book called I think it's The Essential Russell Kirk, which is another good one as well. Great people at the Russell Kirk Center, longtime supporters of the Ciceronian Society and good friends. A place where I go as often as I can to hide from the world, but I do eventually have to leave. It's where I wrote my dissertation. It's where I did a lot of work there. So, anyways, Michael, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Josh, thanks for having me on.
All right, you've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. And as a reminder, we have a second podcast discussing Cicero's seminal work On Duties that is released every Wednesday morning. Be sure to take a look at that one as well. We also have the Fall Symposium, Spring Conference, not to mention our journal Pietas, the annual Herbert Storing Prize, the new Logres Institute, and much more. Make sure to sign up for our newsletter and stay on top of everything Ciceronian Society. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.